The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Good afternoon and welcome to Family First with five-time author and top speaker Randy Rolfe. Your family may be facing a variety of issues that you'd like addressed. No two families in the world face identical problems, but Randy has seen almost all of the difficulties families today face, and she and her expert guests have the answers that you seek. Now, here is your host, Randy Rolfe.
Welcome to Family First. I'm your host, Randy Rolfe, and I want to thank all our listeners. We have 68,000 listeners every month, and we do have an opening for sponsors or advertisers. And do go to my website. I keep putting up new things and opportunities there. I'm very excited about today's show. We're talking about powerful role models, especially for young women or all women. And my guest is Patricia Ortlieb. We often hear how our young people lack role models to inspire them, not only to be ambitious, but also to follow ethical and spiritual principles, even when they have hardships in their careers and lives. Especially for young women and also their mothers, such role models are rare. My guest is Patricia Ortlieb, who has immersed herself in the research and documentation of the life of Eliza Lovell Tibbetts, who, as a pioneer in the 1870s, introduced the navel orange to Riverside, California, and founded the California citrus industry. And we're going to hear all about that. Tibbetts was also an abolitionist, a suffragist, a horticulturalist, a spiritualist, and a mother of a number of children. Patricia Ortlieb, the author of the book, is an artist, psychotherapist, educator, world traveler, management consultant, and also Tibbetts' great-great-granddaughter. Ortlieb's authored the definitive work on Tibbetts with co-author Peter Economy called Creating an Orange Utopia, Eliza Lovell Tibbetts and the Birth of California Citrus Industry. Ortlieb is passionate about introducing children to their heritage and to great role models. She's an artist, author, and educator, and currently docent at the San Diego Museum of Art, where she's been volunteering for the past 10 years. She served for more than two decades as a trainer, counselor, and teacher, specializing in training skills and therapeutic behavior modification, including assertive and humanistic psychology. She's a licensed family therapist. She earned her bachelor's in education and art history at California State University and her MA in social science at Azusa Pacific University. She also received art training at Otis Art Institute in Los Angeles, UCLA, and Pepperdine University. She's traveled extensively, which I love because I've done a whole lot of world travel too, and there's nothing like it. She's visited Antarctica, been on world cruises, and has lived in Spain and Germany. Her travels also took her to Bahia, Brazil, which is the home of the famous navel orange, and she's done paintings, on many paintings, but one particularly on that giant orange, and has donated her voluminous Tibbetts documents to UC Riverside. She wants her sons, grandsons, and granddaughter to know their history, and is excited that her book's getting into schools for youngsters to learn the history. So welcome to Family First, Patricia.
Thank you so much for inviting me on your show today, Randy. I'm really looking forward to telling your audience all about my great-great-grandmother, Eliza Lovell Tibbetts.
That's wonderful. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do, and she's such a fascinating character. So what had you heard about Eliza Lovell Tibbetts when you were a child, before you did all this work?
My grandmother was her granddaughter, so she had the stories from her grandmother direct to her, and she told me her stories, and they had a very close relationship. they were very loving relationship. Eliza had had two daughters of her own, and they both died. And then she had a granddaughter, Daisy, and she drowned in the river. And so when my grandmother came along, she was the only grandchild and dearly loved by Eliza.
Now that's Clara that she wrote to so much?
Yes, that's Clara.
Oh, wonderful. And so what did your own grandchildren know before you started on your research?
Probably very little. And my granddaughter started to study California history in the fourth grade, and I decided that I had to pay attention and get the information that we needed to, so she would have knowledge about her own ancestry. And that led to collecting information about Eliza and Bloom from there.
My goodness, yes, you spent a number of years. There's so much documentation, which you handle so beautifully in the book, because it doesn't weigh it down. It just gives it amazing factual background. So what was that personal journey to doing all that research on Eliza Lovell Tibbetts?
It was very wonderful because I got to involve my children along with me. And we started out by going to Cincinnati because that was her home, Eliza's home, where she was born. And I took my oldest grandson with me, and we had a nice trip. And we shared so many things. We shared the giant orange paintings. The art museum in Riverside had an exhibit of giant oranges, 4x4. This is a big orange, and elected to paint one, and I painted the journey of the orange tree coming from Bahia, Brazil to Riverside. And they got to paint on that. Each one of them painted something.
What a wonderful family enterprise.
Yes, it was. And we gave a talk at this church, and each one of the children took some part of it and reported about their experience and their grandmother, her contribution to the orange industry.
Oh, that's delightful. It's so wonderful to have children involved in a project like that. I homeschooled my children, and it was so neat to be able to pick a project like that and get them involved in the art and the writing and the speaking, and that's just really neat. And you yourself have such a diverse career as an artist yourself, and also in corporate training and humanistic psychology, family therapy. So how did all those dimensions enhance your own research into Eliza's life?
Well, I think all those dimensions, every dimension we study, enhances our approach and our understanding of things. So I would say that's the way I would look at it. It was, she had such a broad experience that it was interesting to get it all together. Each thing surprised us. Like, she went from Cincinnati to New York, and I had always heard, and our family story was that she had sent her son to New York to school. Well, she didn't send him to school. She went with him, and her father went with him, and her husband went with him. So it gave us a whole new picture of her life, just for starters.
Yes, indeed. It's fascinating the kinds of movements that her family went through, and many ways represented. You know, we think of our societies being so mobile, but even this is in the 1850s and 60s, they were already moving around, and she grew up in Cincinnati, but then they were in New York, Washington, and then eventually California. So what was her early life then in Cincinnati? Very interesting influences there.
Yeah, she was the fifth child in a family that were pioneers to Cincinnati. And they were pioneers in building of the city, really. Her father was very active on the city council and in his business and politically and in school. He was active all the way around. So she, being the fifth child, had the benefit of that. And she was raised in a Swedenborgian church that they were members of, and I was able to get a lot of records from the church about her baptism and her life, the life of a church member. And they all went to church three times on Sunday. And her father was a minister for the evening service. So that was different.
Yeah, so she was really steeped in intellectual and religious and community-involved kind of lifestyle for her family. And the Swedenborgians, people don't realize, I think, how what a growing interest that was in the mid-19th century. Johnny Appleseed, Appleseed, and many leaders in those days were followers of Emanuel Swedenborg, who was a Swedish visionary.
Authors and artists, too, were followers of that.
And Helen Keller was a famous Swedenborgian from our own era.
Yes. So that made it interesting to begin with. And she followed that faith her whole life. She was faithful and ideal and church going for her whole life. That was her mainstay, I think. But then she moved from there. She married in Cincinnati and moved to New York for the Civil War, and then to Fredericksburg, Virginia after the Civil War, which was highly unpopular, because she always had a mission, and her mission in Fredericksburg, Virginia was to integrate a farm or a community, and it wasn't popular after the Civil War at that time. But then they moved on to Washington, D.C., where the Agriculture Department was propagating oranges from Bahia, Brazil, because the diet and the food of America was pretty slim, and they were expanding their varieties. And so the minister in Bahia, Brazil sent cuttings of orange trees to Mr. Saunders in Washington, and they Eliza was there in the town, and so when she finally came to Riverside, that's when she asked for them to send her the cuttings. But before that, she was a suffragette in Riverside, in Washington, D.C. Everywhere she went, she got involved, and as a suffragist, she marched with 69 other women and Frederick Douglass to demand the right to vote in 1871. And that's 50 years before the vote was given to women. So she was a woman ahead of her time.
Yes, that's so amazing. 50 years it took for us to get the vote. And she had actually, with that group, I read in your book, she went to register. You know, they went to register and said, you know, we're citizens of the United States. We should be able to vote. And they were trying to register and quite caused commotion, got written up in the newspaper and that kind of thing, and took us 50 years to actually get that done. But I know Emanuel Swedenborg felt that women were intellectually equal, and she adopted that understanding that she was certainly entitled to the same respect and rights that men had. And yet it took us all those years to get that kind of, and we're still working on it to a certain extent as far as equal pay. There was a very interesting news clip in the book about the pros and cons, the newspapers that thought she had a point, and then the others who are saying, why aren't these women at home taking care of their homes?
Yeah.
It was amazing because, you know, it doesn't take long to vote. It doesn't take long. You can inform yourself at home But it was funny. They're saying these were irresponsible women because they were out trying to vote, not being at home, cooking and sewing. Amazing.
It is amazing. It's hard to believe it could happen, but it certainly did.
Yes, and I thought it would. I'd like to ask a little more about the story of their time in Virginia, because trying to give equal rights to the African Americans who were newly liberated as a result of the Civil War, and so many idealists were trying to set up that new society, just like 100 years before, America was a new society, and now they, after the Civil War, they're saying let's integrate the African Americans now that they're no longer slaves, and there was so much opposition, and it was quite frightening that there was so much opposition and violence, and her husband was involved in some of that because people really didn't like the fact that they were friendly with the African Americans and trying to help out. He went to jail for a time, for a few days at least. Isn't that right?
Yes, it was very frightening. They were accused of not paying their rent or something like that. It was rent in the it was in the past. And so it seemed that it was kind of a phony story to get them out of this town, because Luther taught Sunday school at an African American church, and they taught reading as well as a Sunday school, you know, the stories and the traditional Sunday school meaning. And the people didn't want the black people to learn to read, and the law enforcement people were very much against it, and it looks like it was all
trumped up, really, I think.
Yeah,
it was very scary for her young family, and just awful time. And we forget that, just 150 years ago, there was real conflict and persecution of people who wanted to create a happier, newer society after liberating the slaves.
But somehow she was asked to take a child. One of the people that she knew asked her to take her daughter because she knew she would have no future in Fredericksburg. So they took a child and an older woman with them to Washington, and they kept the child and raised her as far as the family.
Yes. Patricia, we're coming up on a break, but I do want to talk some more about that because they did raise the child just like their own, and that was very rare in those days. So when we come back, I want to talk more about their experience in Washington and their constant efforts to live their principles and then going to California. So please, you all stay tuned.
Okay. Find out which guests are being featured this week. Read our network press releases and read the blog posts from your favorite hosts. Go to iradioblog.com today, powered by the Voice America Talk Radio Network.
What if thinking just a little bit differently about your daughter could make her more respectful, a better student, or less vulnerable to peer pressure? What if a few simple changes in your words with your son could make him more responsible, a better listener, or more fun? Five-time author and dynamic speaker Randy Rolfe has answers to your questions about family matters. Whether it's your kids, parents, schools, health and diet issues, finances, or life balance, Randy can help you. The World Ambassador for Family, Randy Rolfe has been helping families since 1985 to minimize the stress and heartache of modern living. to access some great and free downloadable tools, to get one of her internationally acclaimed books, or to have her inspire and excite your next event as your featured speaker, go to www.randyrolfe.com. That's RANDYROLFE.com. Your family will thank you.
The Total Education Network is the only network that airs shows 7 days a week on various stations. Please go to our website, www.totaltutor.org, for more information about the exciting shows coming to the network. The show brings the total education experience. We interview interesting guests, have lively debates, and provide educational news and tips for parents. The Total Education Network, the talk shop for parents, teachers, and administrators. That's www.totaltutor.org.
Looking for exciting video content live and on demand? Visit www.voiceamerica.tv for exclusive content you just can't find anywhere else. That's voiceamerica.tv. Tune in now.
You're tuned in to Family First with your host, Randy Rolfe. To speak to Randy or her guests, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to randyrolfe@randyrolfe.com. Now, back to Family First.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Patricia Ortlieb, who is the author of Creating an Orange Utopia. And we're all speaking about Eliza Lovell Tibbetts, who really gave birth to the California citrus industry, which is one of the largest industries, created a boom like the gold rush in Southern California when the gold rush was just a couple of decades before in Central California. So it's a fascinating story, and it's a great role model for today's young women, particularly. Eliza Tibbetts started out in Cincinnati, a progressive family, pioneer really in founding Cincinnati, and we've been talking about her principled missions. She lived in Virginia right after the Civil War with her family, trying to help with the uplifting of the previous slave population. And then she actually lost a couple of children, and in the book it explains that it was not unusual for children to die in accidents and illness, and often near childbirth in infancy. So it's a fascinating story of persistence and doggedness and principled living. And Patricia, we were just talking about that they actually had to leave Virginia because it was just too dangerous for their family because of the stand they had taken to help the African Americans learn reading as well as religious teaching. So then they moved to Washington. So that was not a bed of roses either.
No, it wasn't.
Can you tell us more about that?
Well, the women stayed in Washington, D.C., while the men went with John North to found the city of Riverside, and they were definitely, it was a colony, and they were, there was nothing there, and they were planning to build a city, a utopian city, with standards and ideals, and so the women were waiting for the houses to be built, and they, Eliza and her daughter-in-law, and her daughter-in-law was one of the first women hired for the Department of Finance, and she was working there, and Eliza, I guess, was busy and active taking care of the family, and her political things, like the March for the Right to Vote. But she was always active in political things and trying to make the place better, contributing. She was a contributor.
It was amazing that Frederick Douglas, as you mentioned earlier, and it's explained beautifully in the book, that he joined with these women knowing that they had, they should have the right to vote. And of course, he's very famous, and he put his mind, his name behind their movement. Fascinating. But
he
took a lot of grief for that too.
He understood their plight. He had been in similar circumstances. So he could join with them. Yes, it was a surprise.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And let's talk a little bit about the oranges, because many of us, we just, you know, we know what's in the supermarket or in our local market, and we don't realize how the foods we eat today have traveled all over the world. They started, the oranges were originally, the navel oranges were originally in India, and the Portuguese picked them up there. Am I right?
Yes, from Goa, India. Well, they started in China.
China
and Persia,
originally.
And then Goa, India, and then the Portuguese, that was a Portuguese colony, and they took them to Brazil, Bahia, Brazil. And this particular orange evolved. It wasn't always just like that. It kept getting better and better. And it is bigger, and it's juicy, and it has a thick skin, and it's sweet. And all the things that the oranges didn't have that were grown in the United States or any place else in the world. So it was really revolutionary.
And apparently them being seedless, that only happened in Brazil, right?
Yes, it is. And so they had to graft everything. Every orange tree today is grafted from the original orange tree.
It's amazing. So
it is amazing.
So it was in 1873 that Eliza got those first two plants from the gentleman at the Department of Agriculture?
Yes, and he said in his diary that she came in and asked for them. We think that she met him socially, probably, or through church, but anyway, she came in and asked for them, and he sent them to her, so they got to California, and they got to her specifically.
Wow. Well, I know there's an Orange County in Southern California. There's an Orange County in Florida. And they were growing some oranges, but nothing like the navel orange that was big, juicy, and sweet and loved the climate. So can you describe Riverside before her husband Luther came or just after he came? What was the situation with the water and the crops?
Well, Riverside had a river, but it was by the mountains. The mountains are in the backdrop, and the desert is in the foreground. And there was nothing there, basically a few Native American houses, but that's all. And so when they came there and started building houses, they really built the town. And they knew what they were doing. They were, you know, organized and educated people. So they went right ahead and did it, made it successful. So it transformed very quickly.
Apparently they had been struggling with all their the problems they had in Virginia and Washington. They'd been financially struggling, and what they did was, because the trees had to be grafted, they sold buds off the original trees, and people all around started buying them and growing the navel oranges all over the area.
Yes, and people had been growing, had planted citrus trees, and these could be grafted right onto the top of those trees. And so they already had roots, and that made it very quick to make it, it turned into a crop very quickly.
And they had been struggling to find something that could really be marketable in that area, right? There were people trying with corn and wheat and silkworms and not doing very well.
And this was just a godsend. It's like Riverside, this crop picks up the state economically, And Riverside became the first, the highest economical city in the nation in just 25 years.
Yeah, that's so amazing that it became the richest area. And there was such a boom. It was very much like what happened in California in the early 2000s. There was a 10 or 12 years there where it was a real boom town. People were coming from all over because of the wealth that these oranges were bringing. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Well, for the gold rush, the people came and left, but for this citrus boom, they came and stayed. And they brought their families, and the cities from Pasadena, right along the mountain south, are all credited to the orange industry. Redlands, all the cities that are along there, Pomona, and so they were organized, and as I said, people were in charge that were educated and had their goals and mission out in front of them.
And they were, as we've said before, very principled. They immediately built libraries and churches and schools.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, they did. They had a lyceum, and they had speakers come, and they were very interested in education. And they had a very good school, and it was very important to them to have the schools and the libraries and the lyceum and organizations to build a variety of churches, just one church. And Eliza was on the board of one of the early Unitarian churches and Universalist Unitarian Church. And she participated in a fundraiser where she was dressed as a gypsy and told fortunes. And somebody said, how much did she charge to tell her fortune? And she said, as much as I can get, because it was for the cause of the library, of course. But it was kind of funny. She was always so good-humored and congenial and ready to participate.
Yeah, the accounts in the book, contemporary friends always remarked on how good-natured and cheerful and full of laughter she was. So she wasn't, some dour pioneer as we might picture. She was quite the cheerful person.
Yes, and she gave very good parties for her children, for their granddaughter. And that invited all the children, and they had very good, nice treats and gifts and things that they didn't have, they said, were not seen in a pioneer's town.
Yeah, I found that very fascinating culturally. I mean, today we make such a big deal of birthdays and graduations and and in those days, kids contributed a great deal. They worked as hard as the parents and just learned as they were working. And to take off time to have a party and teach the kids etiquette and that kind of thing was a fairly new thing. That was fascinating.
Well, her family would have done that because they would have done it for her. And she was sent away to a private school and lived away at school. And that seemed very surprising to me. As early as she was, she was born in 1823, so to be sent away to school would be surprising. But she sent her granddaughter away to school, too, to Los Angeles, so she could have the best education possible.
Yeah, that's very exciting. So when you speak of Eliza Lowell Tibbetts, and I know you do some presentations on her life. What do you think is the most important thing that you want school kids to remember about her story?
Well, she always participated. And wherever she was, she got in and did what was necessary to do. and it was for the good of the people. And when she didn't have much, she contributed anyway. She sent letters. She was always writing letters to shut-ins, and she sent packages to people that couldn't get out, and she visited people and, you know, just contributed wherever she was and whatever she could do.
That's neat. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about her spiritualist side. That sort of seems to be coming back now with all the kids interested in the Twilight movies and everything.
Yes.
There was a huge movement of spiritualism and believing that we can speak to departed loved ones. So what was the role of that belief in her life, Patricia?
She was a medium, and her father was in the spiritualist in Cincinnati. He was a president of the Spiritualist Society, and we couldn't find out much more about it than that, but that seemed to be a very impressive role. And she was known to be a very strong medium, and she could communicate with the other side. Well, then so many children died, and so many mothers wanted to talk to their children and communicate with them, that you can see how that would be important. So she always had her little group together, and they went to Summerland, just south of Santa Barbara, and they came from all over the United States to go to meetings there and to be together. And she had people come to her house and stay with her, and she was connected very well with the mediums around the United States.
That's fascinating, and there's a very detailed description of one of her sessions where she, it's almost like we see sometimes in the movies, where she kind of lost her own identity and through a long process eventually spoke with a different identity that she didn't really remember when she recovered from the session. So very, very interesting part of our history that we aren't that familiar with, but many, many intellectuals and social activists and idealists and religious people were into it. And some of the mainstream churches wanted to distance themselves. Is that right?
Yes, they did. They distanced themselves from the practice of spiritualism. But one church, she wanted to have a meeting of the mediums and a seance, I guess it would be called, in the lobby of the church, and the minister said for some reason they had a disagreement about it, and she couldn't have her meeting. And Vincent Moses, the historian for Riverside, said he was telling a story in that church, and all of a sudden all the shutters banged shut, and there was no wind or anything, and everybody sat silent, and he suddenly said, well, maybe Eliza's having the last word here.
Oh, my. What a great story. We're up on another break now, Patricia, but I want to come back and talk more about Eliza Lovell Tibbetts and her role in the history of Southern California and the country.
Okay.
Learn more. Live better. Voice America Health and Wellness.
What if thinking just a little bit differently about your daughter could make her more respectful, a better student, or less vulnerable to peer pressure? What if a few simple changes in your words with your son could make him more responsible, a better listener, or more fun? Five-time author and dynamic speaker Randy Rolfe has answers to your questions about family matters, whether it's your kids, parents, schools, health and diet issues, finances, or life balance. Randy can help you.
The World Ambassador for Family, Randy Rolfe has been helping families since 1985 to minimize the stress and heartache of modern living. To access some great and free downloadable tools, to get one of her internationally acclaimed books, or to have her inspire and excite your next event as your featured speaker, go to www.randyrolfe.com. That's RandyRolfe.com. Your family will thank you.
Hi, I'm Neil Haley, host of the Total Education Network. We're the only education talk show that airs shows 7 days a week on different stations. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org to learn about the exciting shows coming to the network. The show brings the total education experience. We interview interesting guests, have lively debates, and provide news and provide tips for parents. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org for more information. Remember, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators, TotalTutor.org.
You're tuned in to Family First with your host, Randy Rolfe. To speak to Randy or her guests, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to randyrolfe@randyrolfe.com. Now, back to Family First.
Welcome back to Family First. We have a fascinating guest, Patricia Ortlieb, who, together with Peter Economy, has written a wonderful book called Creating an Orange Utopia, Eliza Lovett Tibbetts and the Birth of California's Citrus Industry. And we've heard great tidbits about Eliza Tibbetts and her fascinating life. She was and Patricia shared with us that the most dramatic part of Eliza's life is how she was always working on a mission. She was an abolitionist. She was for women's voting rights and working rights. She was for education and was absolutely instrumental in the success of the Riverside community, which was originally started as a utopian-style community. And her Swedenborgian and spiritualist background helped make her such a principled person and very dedicated to family, but always involved in the community as well. And so I wanted to talk more, Patricia, about her emphasis on education and how the Riverside community, even when her financial history was definitely up and down, and they did very well during that citrus rush between 73 and 87, but then the economy, local economy collapsed, much like it did in 2007 here. And but no matter what her situation, she was always working to improve the quality of people's lives.
Yes, she was. That was her foremost thing, the people and her family. And she was always dedicated to her family and her granddaughter and her other grandchildren, too. But it was always because she had lost her granddaughter and her other daughters. She focused on my grandmother, who was the first, and the girl.
Yes, and her son actually did a lot with her third husband, Luther. He kind of went with them on their treks and ended up in California and with his family. And Clara was his daughter, right?
Yes, she
yes,
was.
Yes, right. So,
and they were very close family.
Yeah, that's really neat. And I understand that the agricultural research that started as a result of the naval orange success here gave birth to California being one of the horticultural centers of world research.
Yes, it would be.
The UC Riverside was developed out of that original research facility. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's
the whole city is developed out of that research. I mean, basically the industry
It's quite sad that she died when she was 69 or 70, I think. She had some serious bronchial asthmatic problems.
Asthma. And she often went to the beach to get away. You know, Riverside is very dusty. And very dry because it's near the desert. It's very hot and dry in the summer. And to get out of the heat and the dust, she went to the ocean. But she had friends over there, the Episcopal minister and his wife took her in, and she enjoyed the ocean breezes.
Yeah, I'm sure that helped with her breathing. And in Riverside, the family was deeply involved in the water rights issues, too, of trying to get canals to water all these new citrus farms, and that was a lot of complications there, and it's a big history of Southern California, how to find the water. In fact, my daughter's a geologist now in Southern California working with water rights, and it's a fascinating history.
Yes, they had the Santa Ana River. But that was about all, and when it was dry, it was dry. So it was always juggling water.
So that was the beginning, really, of the all the irrigation technology that we benefit from now, not only in California, but around the world.
Yes, California and the drip irrigation. Don't waste any water.
Yeah, now that's required, even in our backyard gardens, to preserve water. So it's been an issue for 150 years. It's a fascinating history.
Well, Eliza wasn't acknowledged very much for many years, and we brought it back to the attention of the people of Riverside, and they brought it back too, but they have a new statue, a beautiful new statue of her that was just dedicated on her birthday, August 2nd, and it's really beautiful, and if anybody would like to go on a little trip, it's very, very nice to see by the Mission Inn, and they've made her icon of the city, so they've distinguished her in that way and honored her. And now the Riverside, the University of California at Riverside, has all the papers that I have and the documents for my research in their library, and so the special collections is going to digitalize those, and anyone can go to see them and avail themselves of it. So that's progress, I think.
Yes, that's really neat. There's a beautiful picture of that new memorial in the book, and it's really lovely. And I'm going to, next time I get to Southern California, I'm going to check out these things. They still have the two parent naval orange trees there.
Yes, they do.
Growing.
Well, they just have Theodore Roosevelt moved it, one of them, from the original place to the Mission Inn patio, and it died after 22 years. But the original one is there, and you can see it on Arlington and Magnolia Street. They have a fence around it, and it's a dedicated historical monument.
That's really neat. It's interesting to, you know, that the president, Teddy Roosevelt, he was very interested in the outdoors and promoting industry and agriculture, and he was there for that dedication. So that shows how important it was viewed in the early 20th century, the importance of that citrus industry for the whole country.
Yes. Put those cities on the map.
Exactly. And often today we assume in popular culture that people who are they're spiritual and on a mission to help people, or they're involved in business. And I think it's really neat that Eliza Tibbetts and her husband were very much involved in not only the spiritual and social life of their communities, but also in their business, in the local business community, and trying to bolster the economics of the environment. And so I think that makes it a particularly valuable role model for our youngsters. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I would agree. I think it's wonderful. And I'd like to read something, just a sentence
oh,
here.
Oh, please do.
This is a letter that Eliza wrote to her granddaughter who, when she was away at school. And she says, "You must never think that I forget you first for one moment. I have you always in my heart, and every day at twilight I pray for you, that the dear Lord will keep your mind and heart fixed on him, that you may love all holy things." I think that tells you what her spirit was like.
Yes, that's very beautiful. Thank you. I really appreciate that, those thoughts. And that's the perfect thing to read. And I know your book is, like so many history books, are kind of long and heavy, but this isn't scary for a child. It's short enough that they could use it for a book report and not be scared away. Did you do that on purpose? Because you had so much material, obviously.
Yes, I do have. I could make it twice that big, but we didn't want to do that. If anybody wants to expand on their knowledge, they can go to the library now and write their own book.
Yeah, that's fun that it's a lot of the documents are being digitized as well. So we're coming up on the end of the show already, and let's tell people you have websites for the book and also Peter Economy. You're both available to speak, and you have what websites do you recommend for people to check out more about the book and also your work as an artist? You have a lot of connections. They can just Google you, actually, which is what I initially did. But what are some of the connections that we should give to the listeners, Patricia?
I would say Peter Economy has a website, and we have a website, but I don't know the name of it or the numbers. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Well, they can Google Orange Utopia, which I think is a wonderful title, because that's what she had in mind, a utopian community, a community where everybody prospers and helps each other. And it was built on the naval citrus orange that she had sent from Washington to their homestead in Riverside.
Yes.
So,
and nurtured and took care of.
I like the website artwork.net/KS, and it shows your giant orange and some of your artwork around Eliza and the oranges, and a nice bio. And it's very easy to get the information. And the book is also on ebook, so if the youngsters have Kindles or Nooks or whatever, they can download the book. It's called Creating an Orange Utopia, Eliza Lovell Tibbetts and the Birth of California's Citrus Industry. So thank you very much for being my guest, Patricia, and good luck with the book and with your art and all the other things you do. And if people go to the San Diego Museum of Art, maybe they'll be lucky enough to have you as their docent.
Thank you, Brandy. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Patricia. Take care now. It's Patricia Ortlieb with Orange Utopia, the story of Eliza Lovell Tibbetts.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We hope you've enjoyed Family First. Please tune in to our program every Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific Time, to join your host, Randy Rolfe, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. The weekend is here. Enjoy it with your family. And we hope to see you here next week.